Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her My People show. I'm your host, Mark Call, and of course, this is a show where we talk about aspects of what that means. The line from Revelation 18, verse 4. About come out of her, my people, so that you do not participate in the sins of whatever it is her is referring to, the beast system, in other words, and therefore do not partake of her plagues. And with that in mind, I'm going to do something I have been doing more and more lately, it seems, and that's to give you the title of the show today before I go too far. I want to call this one Pray for the Wild, Wild West, because after hearing a couple different things this week, it occurred to me that not only are we being lied to about history, and being lied to about current events, and lied to about constitutional issues, and economics, and all kinds of things, but in particular, it's the comparisons with the past that obscure just how far down the rabbit hole, or into the cesspool, if you want to put it that way, we have gone, that I think really make the point. And in particular, especially where that concerns where we're headed and what's likely to be going on. We've seen a number of things in the news over the last weeks and days even that indicate when it comes to war, we're getting pretty close. When it comes to civil war, we're probably even closer. When it comes to economic meltdown, no doubt about it. And even things like famine, where if you watch what's going on in the Midwest with the farming situation, with the over the last 80 years or so, the destruction of the family farm and its replacement by not only big ag, but big poison ag and things like GMO'd frankenfoods. A whole lot of things are going on that most Americans are just plain oblivious to. And indeed, one of those, I think, has to do with, the distortions that we've been fed about what life was like out here, out where your host is doing the show, and of course the mothership at the Hebrew Nation Radio Network and at the other networks that broadcast this show are mostly in the West as well. So what does all of that say? Well, with that in mind, let's take a quick look at some of the history, because here's what I was struck by. Somebody made a reference on some show I was listening to the Wild, Wild West and how nasty things have gotten, and oh, if it gets much worse, it might be like that. And my immediate reaction is, are you kidding me? We have already gotten a hell of a lot worse. And I use that term frequently, as you know, because what's being built around us is a literal hell on earth. Especially if you look at gun-free killing zones like the cities of Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, the District of Criminal Swamp, and so forth. Quite frankly, folks, I would a lot rather live in Dodge City in the 1870s than in either Chicago or the District of Criminals today. Having been to both places, let me assure you, you're probably safer. Now, as I thought about that, I realized, you know what I need to do is take a quick look at some of the history of the real Wild, Wild West and some of the famous gun battles and things that have been memorialized in movies and books and songs and you name it. If I said, pick a city, or at least a major western town where really bad things happened that epitomized the Wild, Wild West, well, probably a couple of names would spring to the top. There's an HBO series a few years ago about Deadwood, South Dakota. Not so much so. How about Tombstone, Arizona, where the infamous gunfight at the OK Corral was held? Or, of course, Dodge City, Kansas. And let's start with Dodge City, because that one's kind of funny. I saw a great piece when I was doing some research for their show from the Saturday Evening Post, dated this year, late May, by Robert Dykstra and Joanne Manfra. This is, again, the Saturday Evening Post. It's called How Dodge City Became the Ultimate Wild West. And, yep, it was fake news and smoking guns that made the Kansas town a symbol of frontier lawlessness. And it starts out by saying, hey, you ever heard the phrase, get out of Dodge? Well, popular culture has epitomized that. may have come from U.S. troops during the Vietnam War. But in any case, the very phrase anchors the idea that it was Dodge City, Kansas, that was the epic world-class theater of interpersonal violence and civil disorder. Vigilanteism and all kinds of nastiness that happens when guns rule the wild, wild west. They give some examples. But the question that the article tries to answer is, well, just how bad was Dodge really? And why do we remember it that way? There are a number of examples from literature and movies that they give. Some of those I'll probably touch on as we go through the background that I'm laying out here for you in this show. But ultimately, the story begins, it says, in 1872, when the Dodge City area was founded by a bunch of male pioneers, six of them immigrants, who founded Dodge City astride the newly laid tracks of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. Early on, it was a cattle center. Major shipping for buffalo hides. It was a cowboy town serving the cattle trails. And it's the, newspaper reporters of the day that made Dodge famous or infamous. For 14 years, they say, the media embellished the town's belligerence and bedlam, both genuine and created, to produce the iconic Dodge City that was and remains a cultural metaphor for violence and anarchy in the celebrated Old West. Trouble is, newspapers in the 1870s crafted the reputation of Dodge City out of a single year of living dangerously, they said, which lasted from July 1872 to July 1873. They lacked judicial and law enforcement structures, and a documented, are you ready for this? 18 men died from gunshot wounds, although newspapers of the time identified nearly half again that number as wounded. And here's where I pause and say, okay, 18 people died in Dodge City. And you know what, folks? Let me be blunt here. That's not even a good weekend in Chicago anymore. Now, the newspapers didn't merely report the news. Does this sound familiar? They interwove it with myths and metaphors of the Old West. It was embellished by famous authors and so forth and so on. Okay, well, you get the idea with Dodge City. We could talk about that some more. Interestingly, it is the scene of a number of TV shows, including famously one of the longest running shows in TV history, Gunsmoke. A lot of people might not be able to name some of the figures that died at the OK Corral. There aren't many anyway. But they might be able to name Matt Dillon, who was the, at least TV sheriff there and so forth. All right, back to the gunfight at the OK Corral in infamous Tombstone, Arizona. Now, here we go. This one, too, is kind of interesting and bears comparison with any average weekend. And, you know, pick a Chicago downtown area where the gang turf wars kill a lot more people than most of the Old West battles combined, again, in a single weekend. The gunfight at the OK Corral, though, it was a 30-second shootout. About 30 rounds in total were fired between lawmen, or at least what passed for them, and members of a loosely organized group of outlaws called themselves the Cowboys. Took place 3 p.m. on Wednesday, October 26, 1881, in Tombstone, Arizona Territory, and is generally regarded as the most famous shootout in the history of the American Wild West. This you can look it up on a number of places, but Wikipedia gets it right in this case anyway. It was a result of a long simmering feud, and we'll come back to some of that in a minute. But first, a brief, quick rundown of Tombstone itself. It was a silver mining town. Silver was discovered nearby in 1877. Tombstone grew quickly into one of the richest mining towns in the Southwest. And some of the names you might remember, Wyatt Earp, former Kansas police officer working as a bank security guard, his brothers, Morgan and Virgil, the town marshal and the law and order. And they had reputations as being both power-hungry and ruthless. Now, that's what's interesting, because it was the Hollywood movies that popularized them as the good guys, but the locals and the reports say it wasn't nearly quite so clear-cut. On the other hand, you had the Clanton gang, Ike Clanton, famously, and his brother, and the McClorys, they call themselves cowboys, but the terminology of the time isn't what we've been led to believe since. In those days, a cowboy was an outlaw. Indeed, this group was. Cattle rustlers, and smugglers, and so forth. And, yes, murderers. Not cowmen, or ranchers, or cattle herders, as the guys who actually earned a living honestly would have been called. In October 1881, the struggle between the two groups for control of Tombstone and Cochise County ended in a blaze of gunfire epitomized in story, movies, and song at the OK Corral. And I won't go through the whole history here. It is kind of interesting, but basically, on October 25th in the morning, Ike Clanton and Tom McClory came into Tombstone for supplies. Over the next 24 hours, the men had several violent run-ins with the Earps and their good friend Doc Holliday. About 1:30 p.m. on the 26th, Ike's brother Billy rode into town to join them, along with Frank McClory, Billy Claiborne. And they met in the local saloon, Doc Holliday, who delighted to inform them that their brothers had been pistol-whipped by the Earps. And the brothers, along Frank and Billy, immediately left the saloon, vowing revenge. Okay, the rest, as they say, is history. And what happened is, hey, get this, folks. Did you know there was gun control in Tombstone? Yeah, it was a city requirement that you left your deadly weapons, and that included Bowie knives and other instruments of destruction, before you could come into town. That is, unless you had a permit. And guess who wasn't going to get permits? So in any case, the gunfight involved the attempt by the Earps to disarm the Clantons and the rest of the gang. 3 p.m., the Earps and Doc Holliday spotted five members of the Clanton-McClory gang in a vacant lot behind the OK Corral. The famous gunfight lasted all of 30 seconds. It's not clear who fired first. Most reports say it began, though, when Virgil Earp pulled out his revolver and shot Billy Clanton point-blank in the chest, while Doc Holliday fired a shotgun blast at Tom McClory, killing him. And ultimately, when it was all over, folks, Billy Clanton, Tom and Frank McClory were killed. That's three dead. And Morgan was wounded, Morgan Earp, along with his brother Virgil and Doc Holliday. But the most famous gunfight in Western history basically involved about three dead. There was, of course, some follow-up violence and an execution of one of the other remaining Earps. Not Wyatt, of course. He ended up later in Dodge City, if I remember correctly. But let's compare and contrast things like that for just a second here. Because it's interesting to me. Here are some numbers from this year in gun-free Chicago, the gun-free killing zone of Chicago, where, well, basically, the only people who are truly gun-free are the honest, law-abiding citizens who aren't either on the take, working for crooked law enforcement, or part of some gang, of which Chicago has legions of them. 60 or 70 different gangs, by most counts, the Chicago papers report, and well over 100,000 gang members in gun-free, but not really Chicago. So far, this year, and the year's only about half over, over 1,000 people have been shot. Now, I hesitate to give the numbers, of course, because they're probably changing as we speak. Another OK Corral shootout or two may well have happened before I finish the show. But here we go. 1,043 people, as of the weekend anyway, dead in Chicago, shot in Chicago this year, sorry. Over 1,000 over the last few months, obviously, and 211 of those, or maybe 17, it's hard to say, but it keeps changing again, are dead, officially. So, again, compare any of the famous gunfight cities. I went through some lists. There's a list on Wikipedia of all the major gunfights in the West, and basically, again, add them all up together. You're not talking about quite a good weekend in Chicago. And yes, again, remember that both Tombstone and Dodge City, the scenes of the most famous gunfights and the greatest violence, also had gun control. Is it a correlation or is it just a, well, one of those unfortunate facts of history that you're not going to hear about? By the way, in Tombstone, it was called Ordinance Number 9, to provide against the carrying of deadly weapons, took a permit. So all kinds of stuff, I guess you'd say, that's interesting. I did find this as I was looking through the Dodge City information, for example. Here are some other amazing statistics. Dodge's local handful of yarn spinners endorsed all of the nonsense that became legendary over time. And the total estimates of people interred on infamous Boot Hill ranged originally from 81 to more than 200. But by the 1930s, the town's consensus had really figured out it's probably more like 33 people, and that included victims of illness as well as violence. A best-selling biography of Wyatt Earp, published in 1931, still in print, boosted that body count maybe to as many as 70 or 80. But again, folks, Chicago has almost that many on the average weekend. And it's movies and TV that got into the act and made Dodge the, well, film star that it is today. I've mentioned Gunsmoke already, a 20-year serial, the longest-running primetime ever show, at least of its time, and pretty much ever since then, ever aired. Imaginary Dodge, says this piece from the Saturday Evening Post, is still hard at work helping Americans chart their moral landscape as the archetypal bad civic example, promoting the belief that things could never, ever possibly be as bad as they were in the Old West, because we Americans have survived and indeed thrived and even evolved into a civilized society. I guess it's helpful to distort history so that you can look at places like Chicago, New York City, L.A., Washington, D.C., Detroit, most of the other major gun control leftist capitals. For crying out loud, don't even talk about San Francisco. The major way you might die there is stepping on a needle or slipping in a pile of you-know-what. Although it's possible an illegal might shoot you in the back in that sanctuary city, as has happened. Again, the point is, it's well, illustrative when you compare facts with fiction and modern hell on earth kinds of things with the worst of what people think of as the wild, wild west. Bottom line, folks, you are one heck of a lot safer walking through any place in the Old West than you are walking through almost any place in one of the leftist, sanctuary, gun-free, killing zone cities in America with a K. Now, from there, what I want to do is add a little bit of, other information to the fire here. I'm looking at a piece from, in this case, it's Dave Hodges, writing for the Common Sense Show, about American sanctuary cities and the various drug cartels that are famously, well, taking over America and seem to have already taken over the District of Criminal Swamp. It's been, I think, clear for a long time that the Dixie Mafia has run the District of Criminals, although it may be that some other elements within the swamp are running the Dixie Mafia. But the parallels with the real levels of gang violence that are so prevalent today, and by the way, that helped Chicago since the 1920s, and Al Capone, and the area and the era that ushered in major gun control in the United States, become exactly what they are. So here you are. Now, this piece from Hodges notes by he begins by saying he wants to take a critical look at the importation of violent gangs into America, especially criminal gangs entering via the southern border with New Mexico. He's talking primarily about things like MS-13, and I guess when you talk about terrorist groups, ISIS infiltration and cells being set up, that's actually a whole different deal. But he does note that he has an informant, a high-ranking Texas Ranger, who told me that if I really want to understand what's going on, focus on the gangs and terrorists coming into Texas, because Texas is literally losing control to prevent major attacks on Texas towns and cities. And, of course, I've done stories lately about New Mexico, their crooked criminal leftist governor who essentially ordered Trump's National Guard in the New Mexico case out of the border area up until just recently when she's changed her tune and said, all of the stuff that she was calling overhyped nonsense, now she's screaming about because evidently, she's hearing it from people that are sick and tired of what's going on down there. Says Hodges, I've been in communication with a DEA source, too, for at least 5 years. He informs me that something called the Plaza System, under the direction of the various drug cartels, is appearing in sanctuary cities inside the United States. And here's the kicker, folks. Now, compare all of this, the worst of the worst, to, criminal areas like Dodge City and Tombstone, and just see which one you might prefer to live under. I would, for example, take any of those places over at San Francisco for sure. I can remember a few decades back when I was a working engineer traveling to San Francisco and enjoying going to the Embarcadero and riding the trolley cars and eating at some of the nice restaurants and staying downtown and visiting Chinatown and all that kind of stuff. But those who have been forced to go there more recently tell me, no, I didn't leave my heart in San Francisco. I might have left something on the street, but that's more like a place you don't want to go anymore. Sanctuary cities like San Francisco, famously, I've done the stories, refuse to prosecute illegal immigrants for things like child sex trafficking and drug distribution. Well, it's obvious, suggests Hodges, that you have to assume they're on the take. When we see Mexican politicians on the take, as many or even most are, it's difficult not to assume that the people in the sanctuary cities that we see doing the same things might be also on the take. He quotes a number of people with a number of statistics. I've mentioned some of them. We might get to a few more here as we go through this. But the bottom line is that America is being actively and quickly transformed into a narco-terrorist state right before our eyes. And he says all of this that he wants to go over will demonstrate what's coming to America, first in the sanctuary cities, and then later, as all of these business models spread across the country, well, to a theater near you. Soon it won't be safe for many of you to walk outside your home. If you thought Dodge City was bad, well, look out the door. The criminal forces are already here. He looks at communities like Humboldt County, California. Chinatown is a hotbed of activity with a marriage between the communist Chinese, drug cartels, and corrupt American politicians. This is what America is transforming into. His DEA sources are telling him about the emerging criminal empire in this country. More politicians, especially in the border states under cartel control, are part of the endeavor than not. And if you think it's bad in the southern U.S., well, look at narco-terrorist empire Mexico. This is what your country, he says, is transforming into. And, of course, as you know, Mexico is not only a narco empire, but has complete gun control as well. Well, that is for the peons, kind of like Chicago, not so much for the politicians on the take and the various criminal cartels that truly run things. And to make all of this, to bring home the point, this is one of the elements that made me think about doing this show, too. There was a major gun battle, bigger by far than the gunfight at OK Corral, held on the American-Mexican border just south of Arizona in the town of Agua Prieta. In two separate gun battles, at least 10 people, mostly Mexican drug cartel members, but there were some innocent bystanders shot too, were killed. They were fighting over turf and the right to control drug trafficking in the plaza system, they call it. Now, I've used that term a couple times now. It's akin to a small fiefdom in which territorial kingdom tribe control emanates from the various cartels, and of course they fight over turf. The Sinaloa cartel is the biggest of all the cartels. They have ships, drugs, child sex trafficking, and Lolita Express and the Clinton family about some of that. Into the United States. In other words, both sides of the gunfight are members of the Sinaloa cartel. They were just having a friendly discussion about which of the local mob bosses was going to control drug trafficking through their small border town. And just this week we had a senator come out and reveal that the amount of and value of drug trafficking, child sex trafficking, and other criminal enterprises coming in through the border. Hey, and this is why the leftists in control of just about everything in the District of Criminal Swamp don't want to change it. Ready for this? $500 billion a year. Now, that's not counting the welfare state implications of all the criminals, terrorists, and others that are being imported to overthrow the formerly free United States. $500 billion a year, folks. And that is a budget for the cartels that's, well, let's just put it this way. For all those people that worry about how much the American military spends, almost none of it, by the way, actually spent defending that border. Maybe it's obvious now why. The Sinaloa cartel would be up there, at least in second place worldwide, with military capabilities, I guess you'd say. America is, again, being transformed right before our eyes. He goes through the Pablo Escobar story, right, the Medellin cartel, which popularized the idea of widespread murder, where nobody was off limits to assassination. Politicians, police, military, judges, businessmen, journalists, anybody else who got in their way might fall victim to the Medellin cartel. He gives a number of the names, at least 8 major political figures, judges, candidates, and so forth. And that doesn't include thousands of smaller fry, police officers, military personnel, reporters, that were victims one way or the other of all of this. Sinaloa Cartel Murder Incorporated Mexico. Isn't it interesting? Again, gun-free Mexico recorded a whopping 2,513 killings last year. Let's see, add up the entire wild, wild west, and you probably get the lower couple of decimal points here. All of this, though, says the story funded by a surge in the demand for methamphetamines. Lots and lots of crime, lots and lots of murder, and all of it metastasizing rapidly like a cancer. We'll be right back. I'll give my head to the youth, I'm the loser.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Come Out of Her, My People show. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and we're talking today about, something that I would suggest people consider and even do, and that's pray for the Wild Wild West. Why do I say that? In other words, given what I have suggested for a while is coming and why it is important that we begin the process of coming out of her, separating ourselves from the nasty stuff that's going on so that we can hopefully separate ourselves from the nasty results of that. By the way, that includes so many of the major leftist socialist enclaves, gun-free killing zones, as I like to refer to them, places like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and, well, basically just any big metropolitan area where the leftists have run things aground for so long. You're a heck of a lot safer in any of the rural areas of the United States, even the Wild Wild West today, of course, than you would be in any of those places, and you're a lot safer in almost anywhere today, and that would include places like Tombstone, Arizona, and Dodge City, than you would be in those major gun-free killing zones, too. Now, the problem is the following, and this is kind of where I was headed. It's part of the reason I went through some of the history in the first segment here. Look online, just do a quick search. The gunfight at the OK Corral, Tombstone, Arizona, Dodge City, famous gunfights in the Wild Wild West. You'll find lots and lots of historical detail. And the story is kind of fascinating. There's all kinds of information you can find out about this infamous gunfight that resulted in the killing of three people and the wounding of several more. And yet, folks, again, that doesn't even make a blip in the Chicago area local papers on the average weekend in the gun control mecca of the machine-run socialist Chicago state. It's been infamous since, the 1920s. We'll come back to that in just a second. But what I think is perhaps even more telling is that as the invasion from the South continues, and yes, there are all kinds of other things besides just drug cartels and mob violence to be concerned about, like Ebola, for example, that's being set up, I will contend, because now we have stories about large numbers of, no, not just Mexican or OTMs, other than Mexicans. For a long time, of course, we've had the ISIS folks infiltrating with the tens or hundreds of thousands moving across the borders, basically unimpeded. But in addition to Hondurans and El Salvadorans and Guatemalans and so forth, you have, of late especially, large numbers of people from the Congo, other African nations. Isn't that interesting? They come all the way across. Somebody's paying for that. And they land in Mexico or even further south, and they make their way north because there are all kinds of free goodies to be had here. And they're not going to be stopped. Oh, if you bring along some kids, even if they're sex slaves, that will help too. And it looks like, given the statistics from the very few that are actually being DNA tested, there's a huge percentage that claim to be families because that's your ticket to the, freebies in the socialist United States that really aren't families either. But along with what's being imported in the way of drugs and child sex trafficking and just disease and other things, Mexican authorities, get this, opened 33,341 official murder investigations last year in 2018. That's the highest ever. This was a recent report, and that outpaced even the year before's total of 25,000. Well, compare that, for example, to the worst of the worst of the Wild Wild West. And this is what's coming to America. Hodges closes his article with a picture of some of the, wonderful people that are being imported to America carrying signs in the People's Republic of California, one of which said, and this was downright amazing, "Give us free health care, jobs, no taxes, house and food. You owe us, America," said the sign. And under that, the threat. I guess this was Phoenix, as it turns out. "We will shoot more police in Arizona until we get free." Oh, there you go. if you invite something, you're going to get more of it. I think it's how the old saying goes, and we're certainly seeing that as well. All right, speaking of inviting things and how all of this begins to fit together, I want to make a point that I have made for a long, long time. The birth of true organized crime in America can be traced to the 18th Amendment, ratified in the year 1919. This was prohibition, of course. Now, up until this, you had some criminal activity, political connections, experience being gained in things like gambling and prostitution rackets in the early 1900s. But it was the Volstead Act, prohibition, and the 18th Amendment that really put the mafia on the map. By illegalizing the production and distribution and consumption of alcoholic beverages, all of which were corollaries, well, that didn't curb the desire of people for speakeasies, liquor or beer. This great demand, said an article I'm looking at here, about the, well, process of developing the mafia. And simultaneous illegalization of alcohol opened up a whole new illegal market for the gangster to move in, develop, and of course, monopolize. Because the beautiful thing about prohibition, whether we're talking alcohol then or drugs now, oh, and ironically, once upon a time it took a constitutional amendment. Isn't that ironic? Well, back when we had a constitution. Nowadays, they don't pay any attention to that, and we have a market and a problem that dwarfs anything that Chicago experienced in the roaring 20s. But interestingly, Al Capone put it this way. This is a book quoted several times, written in 1929, called Rattling the Cup on Chicago Crime by a man named Sullivan. But he quoted Al Capone to say, "All I do is supply a public demand. Somebody had to throw some liquor on that thirst. Why not me?" And Sullivan goes on to note that Chicago's change for the worse, or to the worst with a T, was exactly coincidental, isn't this amazing, with the beginning of Prohibition. Al Capone arrived in Chicago in 1920. He inherited the leadership of the Torrio gang, and of course, if you've seen Scarface or any of the Godfather series or a bunch of other movies, The Untouchables and so forth, you know about the legend. All of these activities, though, were deemed illegal under Prohibition. Isn't that funny? Capone bought legal immunity, though, by, get this, administering bribes. Who could have imagined such a thing to police and politicians? He paid off practically every law enforcement agent and politician in the districts. I guess if he couldn't, he killed them, in which he operated his illegal businesses. The bribes, sometimes they were as much as $250,000, but, you know, little threats will reduce the amount that you have to pay out. But they were still easy. Ready for this? Because Capone earned, depending upon whose numbers you believe, between $60 million and $100 million a year through his illegal drug, well, actually in those days, alcohol trafficking empire. And, of course, they branched out into other things as well. $100 million, folks, in the Roaring Twenties, back when a $20 gold piece was $20, well, do the math, it's real money. So we're talking about literally the equivalent of billions of dollars annually. And that, of course, well, that'll buy you a whole lot of influence, won't it? And ironically, if you step forward and look at what's going on today with the Dixie Mafia, the control of the D.C. criminal organizations, and that would include the federal bunglers of instigation and so forth, I have contended for a long time, you can see that the criminal mob epidemic has gone national, and it's gone deeper, and it's gone more pervasive. And yes, most Americans don't seem to be too concerned as long as the FBI just tries to influence elections and blames that on the Russians and so forth. But ultimately, this entire history here is educational because it shows us not only what happened, but if you extrapolate and look at what's gone on in Mexico, what is happening and will happen here. The idea, says the article, that money can buy power was lucidly verified by gangsters like Capone. His bootlegging functions led to political and violent physical power as well, and that enabled the gangs to find new evidence, new avenues to exploit their business opportunities, all kinds of illegal things, old businesses like gambling and prostitution, and new ones. They got into labor racketeering, and that, of course, is famous. You can see these in the movies as well. This is one of the places where at least there's some evidence of truthfulness that made its way in. The Godfather series, I think, was particularly good in that regard, even though it was fictionalized. You can pretty well tell who most of the major players are. Trouble is, anybody who was confronted by a gangster wanting in on their business, that was true then, it's still true now, especially in the district of criminals, it would seem, knew they better yield in fear of being executed. And, of course, here's another part of the problem. We're seeing this with some of the public-private fascist partnerships today. You watch my back, I'll watch yours. You guard my businesses, you subsidize my businesses. I'll let you have back doors to monitor people. This is the socialist media platforms and all of the things that are going on with censorship and prohibition of alternatives and helping the pharmacopoeia complex, big pharma, a big poison, big ag, essentially to be able to get away with all the things they're getting away with, essentially scot-free. And now we're seeing that if you talk about it, if you even point out that there just might be a problem with vaccines, who knows what's in them? Well, you're not going to be allowed to because Gulag and Twitter and two Facebook will cut you off and so forth. All we're seeing today, folks, is that the mobster enterprises that were pioneered and perfected by the Al Capones of the 1920s and then really ran into high gear with the Clinton-Bush crime families in the latter part of the 20th century are now so endemic that, well, all we need to do is just wait to see what happens in Mexico as it's moving across the border. Here's the bottom line on the public-private partnerships from the Prohibition and well, all of the wonderful fruit that it has wreaked article. The involvement of gangsters with legitimate business wasn't always done against their will because the racketeer was often called forth to improve business. Now ask yourself, isn't that exactly what you're seeing with the modern public-private partners, whether we're talking media or socialist media platforms? Oh, yeah, you want a backdoor into my system, my operating system, my two Facebook data mining and so forth. You know, NSA does that, but Facebook has a lot of people literally volunteering to give up their data. It makes sense that the birds of a feather would flock together. All of this, too, is about trying to control competition while circumventing the Antitrust Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act back in those days. Nowadays, of course, we find that the real trusts that run socialist media, well, they're immune to all of that. And while the president may talk about it, hey, at the rate things are going, folks, don't expect to see any real action before most of the alternative venues for information are shut down. Power of the mob was evident by the numbers of people who yielded to its request and by the fact that the non-compliant were ruthlessly murdered. In the last few days, there have been no less than two state senators in the United States, let me think, Arkansas or Oklahoma, I lose track, but that have been, well, found murdered. Oh, but there's no connection there, don't worry. Nothing to see here, move along, move along. Here's how this particular piece, now this is from the universityofmichigan.edu, it's entitled Organized Crime, How It Was Changed by Prohibition. The article concludes by saying that there seem to be two main reasons why labor racketeering in particular prevailed, because a situation of cutthroat competition among small business enterprises, in other words, they wanted them in, and it's easier than actually engaging in price competition, and secondly, because of, quote, get this, a tradition of lawlessness and violence in Chicago. And some of these things were written decades ago. That tradition, of course, has merely expanded with the likes of the modern Chicago mayors and mob bosses. But, yes, I repeat myself. And, again, what would be more natural? Out of Al Capone and the Roaring Twenties came the idea that we don't actually have to have a constitutional amendment to prohibit and to infringe the living you-know-what out of firearms. FDR got away with it in the 1930s with the National Firearms Act. Unconstitutional as all get out, but again, they got away with it because, oh, Al Capone used, what, Thompson submachine guns, right? The dreaded Tommy gun. And therefore, you peons aren't allowed to have it. Now, guess what happened? Amazingly, the mafia mob alcohol gangs, back in those days, they were getting away with murder. They were getting away with things that were already outlawed by the Constitution. What the heck? Why bother with outlawing guns and worrying to change the Constitution? Because we know that the real criminals are going to ignore that one, too. But it'll give us an ability to control the lesser ones. Bottom line, let me say this again. Let's go back, and when we hear people talking about the Wild Wild West and how dangerous it was, how horrible it was, what the worst thing you could imagine would be a return to the kind of lawlessness that we had when people could strap a gun on their hip, as indeed they in fact can in much of the formerly free United States today that doesn't have New York or Illinois or California or Massachusetts-style gun control. But there you go. It was dangerous when people could defend themselves, but not nearly as dangerous as it is nowadays when they can't. So, again, the point here is to pray for the Wild Wild West. Do the comparisons and just simply look at the numbers, the number of people that are killed in the narco state of gun-free Mexico or the terror state of gun-free Chicago, and compare that to the worst of the worst. At the gunfight at the OK Corral or Dodge City or you name it. All right, when it comes to mob bosses and crime, though, perhaps we couldn't even do a show like this without at least mentioning the federal bunglers of investigations or the Federal Bureau of Instigation, the organization that seems to have been involved in the cover-up of the assassination of a sitting president. Hey, was there a mob involvement there, too? Well, maybe it's all repeating itself. Talking about JFK, of course, and the magic bullet and the crimes that were covered up by the Warren Commission and so forth. Then we had the Oklahoma City investigation that wasn't. We've had any number of famous cases that have been covered up. Interestingly, just a few days before the 9/11 false flag and mass murder terror event in New York City that brought us all kinds of additional unconstitutional things like the Anti-Terror Acts and Patriot Acts and so forth, a fellow named Robert Mueller, the sainted Bob Mueller, was installed as the fixer, the head of the FBI. What an amazing coincidence. And yeah, he did exactly what he was put in there, because the real truth has still not come out about that one either. So here's a piece that I'm looking at. This comes from Victor Davis Hanson at the National Review, repeated in a number of sites across the country. The FBI tragedy, it's called Elites That Are Above the Law. Well, gee, doesn't that sound just like Al Capone, just like most of the narco-terrorists in Mexico, and just like what's going on in the swamp? After decades, the FBI and the top brass came to believe that they too, like Al Capone, I guess that those who learned what it was like to be on the take in Chicago and brought their message to Washington, think the last regime, and pursue their own political agendas, realized they could get away with almost anything. One of the media and beltway orthodoxies, this story begins, that we constantly hear, in addition to references to the Wild Wild West, I guess, is that it's just a few bad apples. Folks under James Comey, the whoremeister at the top of the crooked FBI. Well, that explains, yeah, that's it, why so many FBI elites have been fired, reassigned, resigned, demoted, or retired. Or maybe they just left for unexplained reasons. The list is long, though, of criminals and other scumbags at that now long discredited institution. It includes the former director, whoremeister himself, James Comey, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, acting director for a while, counterintelligence agent, counter to our intelligence anyway, Peter Strzok, paramour, attorney Lisa Page, chief of staff James Rybecki, general counselor James Baker, assistant director for public affairs Mike Corton, special assistant Josh Campbell, executive director James Turgle, assistant director, yada, 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 all kinds of names of people, basically up to their elbows and stuff that would have probably made Al Capone blush. But the bottom line is, in short, says the piece, just about every growing scandal over the past 2 years, from the FISA lying, illegal leaking, spying on a presidential candidate, well, indeed, spying on everybody, lying under oath, obstructing justice, well, somebody in the FBI is certainly involved, and of course, the other clandestine agencies, NSA, CIA, you name it, they all have three letters, and therefore, they're part of that same bird of prey. But we're told that it's the FBI's culture and institutions that are truly exempt from the widespread wrongdoing at the top. Well, folks, a fish rots from the head. And the truth is, absolute power corrupts absolutely. If you go back and look at history and ask yourself, what is it that Al Capone showed? Sure, if you got enough money, you can buy almost anybody. I can remember having made this comment when I first started doing radio 2 decades ago. If you have the ability to control billions of dollars, You can buy Congress critters. You can indeed, as we've seen, you can buy presidents and presidential candidates. And if you can't buy them, you can have them killed. Is it any surprise that what we've seen therefore follows? Kind of like mass murders follow gun-free killing zones. Is it possible, right? Just possible, that we've seen plenty of evidence about the insurance policy, the idea of how Hitler was supposed to win. Let's take out a presidential candidate. There's your real election rigging. And why, oh why, would somebody like, well, the sainted McCabe even consider overseeing an FBI investigation of Hitler's improper use of emails when his very own wife had been a recent recipient of lots and lots and lots of Clinton-related PAC money? Why? I think the answer is obvious. Why would McCabe contemplate leaking confidential FBI information to the press? Well, their captive press. Or dream of setting up an operation to remove a sitting president using the 25th Amendment, and so forth and so on. Well, the list of skullduggery and scumbaggery is long, but the bottom line seems to be this. Why, in other words, did so many top FBI officials, many with long experience at the FBI, exhibit such bad judgment, display such unethical behavior, characterized by arrogance, a sense of entitlement, and a belief they were both above the law and the Constitution itself? Were they really just rogue agents, lawyers, and administrators, or emblematic of an FBI culture? Well, I'll go further, folks. A deep state criminal culture sorely gone wrong. He goes into Mueller himself. Remember, this guy had a connection with the mob killer, Whitey Bulger, FBI informants, and lots of other sleazy stuff. The truth is, everything I've been talking about today from the opening music has had to do with organized crime, has had to do with various kinds of prohibition, and true to form, just about any libertarian can tell you this, you prohibit something, you make it more profitable, you're going to get more of it, at least among the criminal element, and less among those who actually think that the law means something. Hint, hint. They do not rise to the top of the scum in the district of criminal swamp. What does rise, though, and I guess we're seeing it rising north, is the narco-terror state out of Mexico. And what we've been seeing for a long time, but it seems to be coming to a head now, is the Mexicanization of America as we adopt more and more of the failed techniques that history, our own history, has proven are such a disaster, like prohibition itself. And again, remember, prohibition of guns, that didn't take a constitutional amendment. Prohibition of drugs, that didn't take a constitutional amendment. I guess the bottom line is, pretty obviously, we don't have a constitution anymore. What we have is a narco-terror state and a whole bunch of people who, whether they run for president or sit in the hallowed halls of the FBI, are above the law. And the law doesn't mean squat. I think it's funny, then, as we wrap things up, to reflect on Dodge City and the claim that, oh, in Dodge City we had lawlessness, and there was the problem. Well, maybe that's true, folks. But the presence of so-called law enforcement has nothing to do with it, as we can now see by looking around. What does law enforcement do in the United States today? Answer, enforce what passes for law, as George Orwell once put it in Animal Farm, against the rest of the people, because some animals are more equal than others. Remember, it was the pigs in those days, in that book, that were more equal than others. And I guess it's still the pigs that are running the show. So what's the real bottom line with all of this? Well, when I say pray for the Wild Wild West, I'm actually not kidding. Because given what's coming, given our understanding of history and economics and prohibition, it's important that we recognize, as we come out of things, what we need to be coming back to is a real rule of law based on Scripture. That was the way the thing that we once called the Constitution was set up. It was all based on Scripture. We didn't need laws at the federal level like thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not steal, because we had them. But now, if you have a federal license, you can do all of those things. And if 51% in a democracy that we never actually had either vote to take your life, liberty, and property, well, that's okay too. Lawlessness does indeed abound. And if you want to understand another alternative to lawlessness, look and see what the Wild Wild West was really like outside of the gun control zones. And ask yourself, where would you rather be, especially given what we all know is coming? And what really matters, of course, is the law that's in our hearts and who we serve. Once upon a time, we had a nation dedicated to those self-evident principles. Sadly, we're not there anymore. And so what that means is each of us, we still have the ability to make a choice. And Scripture lays it out this way. Choose life. Know who you serve. May Yahuwah bless you and yours.